Why should he be afraid? Or afraid of? Or aggrieved at the death of his relatives, since he was discharging his proper duty? He did not deserve to break the law, thereby becoming subjected to the reactions of sinful acts, of which he was so afraid. By avoiding the discharge of his proper duty, he would not be able to stop the death of his relatives, and he would be degraded due to his selection of the wrong path of action. This verse is talking about the inevitability of death and of being reborn. Some may not like to hear about such things. Why do we have to talk about death? Why can't we just enjoy life while we're alive? But that is a materialistic way of thinking, naive. Those who are philosophically inclined, who think seriously about the real situations of our life, they usually consider the problem of death. They don't ignore it because it's an unpleasant subject. Even you can look at the words of wisdom printed on the new 7-Up bottles. It says, you read it, the back of the bottle, 7-Up, 2-liter bottle. Life is short, so live it up. That means we're all going to die, and therefore enjoy. Because the conclusion is wrong. But the philosophical idea is, yes, jatasya hidruvom vityur. Same idea. Or the atheist materialist Chanakya, who formed a kind of philosophy of hedonism. He wrote, now we don't have many things that he wrote, but we have this one shloka. Rinam kritva gritam bibet yava jivet sukam jivet basmi bhutasya dehasya kim punar agam obhavet. Again, talking about death. Prabhupada translates, says, go into debt if you have to, get ghee. Or Prabhupada translated it, beg, borrow, or steal. But get ghee. What do you do with ghee? You fry pakora. He's a materialist, thinking about eating some nice fried food. He doesn't say, get hamburger. Even the idea of meat eating is not even, back then, was not even considered fit to print, obscene idea. Only disgusting people were eating meat. Charvaka Muni wrote this. So he's the materialist, but he's talking vegetarian materialist. Get some ghee. Even the materialists were vegetarians then. And enjoy life. As long as you're alive, enjoy. Because when your body is burnt to ashes, who can put those ashes back together again? Again, talking about death, from a materialistic point of view. This is, philosophers are like that. They talk about death. And actually, if they're not willing to talk about death and consider that problem, then they're not real philosophers. Shripad Madhvacharya, in his Vishnu Tattva Vinirnaya, he writes, yasya na dharma dharmo na cha samayi. If someone doesn't have concept of religion and irreligion, then he's not a philosopher. You know, if he's amoral and has no concept of what is religious and what is irreligious, he's no philosopher. So according to that, this Charvaka Muni was not a philosopher. Anyway, how can you have an idea of what is your duty in the real sense if you don't think about the fact that you're going to die? If you ignore the fact you're going to die, it doesn't matter what you do. Get away with anything, just don't get caught. And live your life as long as you can live. Enjoy it. You can't have a proper concept of dharma, of duty, the higher duty of man, unless you understand we're going to die. Not only that, we have to take birth again. Then, when we accept those two facts, when we acknowledge them, then we have to think seriously about dharma and adharma. Because what we do now, we will get reaction for it. If not in this life, then in the next life. Then we become serious about dharma. Then we can call ourselves philosophers. Therefore, Krishna is talking like this. Arjuna, we should be talking philosophically here. We have to consider, think seriously about what you're saying, Arjuna. You want to refuse to fight. Don't you realize, as Prabhupada points out in the purport, that that would be sinful? For you not to fight this battle is a negligence of your duty. Your duty, you are a kshatriya. You are obliged to fight. You've already come to this battlefield. You're sitting on your chariot. You've agreed to fight this fight. You cannot walk away from it. That would be sinful. You're complaining about teaching, killing your relatives, including Bhishma and Drona, your gurus. But if you don't try to kill them, that is sinful. And you know, and to underline that point, Krishna is saying in this verse, since anyway, everybody's going to die. It's only a question when. Therefore, it's unavoidable. Actually, Krishna tells Arjuna later in the 11th chapter, during the exhibition of the Virat Rup universal form, the universal form, Krishna in that form tells Arjuna, Mayaiva eta nihita purvam eva nimitta matram bhava savya sachin. All these great warriors on this battlefield, I've already killed all of them. This is before the battle. But Krishna says, I've already destined them all to die. I've decided. All of them, except for a small handful of these millions of soldiers, only 5 or 6 will not be killed. Panchashat avasheshita. After the battle, you could count on two hands, 6 fingers, how many soldiers survived. How many warriors were not killed in that battle? 5 Pandavas and 1 or 2 other people, that's all. Everyone else is dead. And Krishna says, before the battle, Krishna says, I've already decided it. These men are all dead. I'm asking you, Arjuna, nimitta matram, just be my instrument. You help me do this. It's going to be done anyway. If you avoid your duty, they're going to be killed anyway, and you'll be sinful for not doing your duty. That Krishna will say later. But he's hinting at it now. It's unavoidable. Apariharya. Death is unavoidable. You cannot stop it. You can postpone it. You can try to postpone it, but you cannot stop it. And what is also unavoidable is rebirth. Now this is a very basic fact of spiritual knowledge. Practically everybody in India knows that. Even those who don't think that they're Hindus. They may consider themselves Jains or Buddhists or even Christians, but even the Christians and the Muslims, even though they're not supposed to be believing in reincarnation, but they're Indians. And everybody in India, any rickshawwala, any farmer can tell you, of course, you know, after you die, you have to take birth again. It's common knowledge. It's part of the culture to understand the principle of reincarnation. But in the modern Western world, reincarnation is a strange idea. And the big philosophers in the universities don't understand it. Or they don't recognize it, or they're ignorant of it. Simple fact. Simple fact. Krishna shouldn't even have to tell this to Arjuna. But in the very beginning of the Gita, Krishna's just to make sure that everybody, because not only Arjuna, so many devotees in the future are going to read the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna wants to make sure that the basic facts are understood before he gets complicated, before he gets onto more advanced topics. He wants to make sure everybody understands. First of all, the soul is eternal. Second of all, the body is not. Every person in a material body is going to suffer the death of that body and is going to have to take another body and be born again. But the soul is eternal. Two basic facts. That is not the essence of the knowledge of the Gita. It's just preliminary information that most, at least Indian readers, should know already. Arjuna certainly knows these two facts already. He's a well-educated Kshatriya, Yadu prince. He's not ignorant about this. He's studied Shastra. He's read Upanishads. He knows all this. But to make sure that all the readers, everyone who hears Bhagavad Gita, doesn't have any misunderstanding about this, in the very beginning, this is still the beginning of the second chapter, these very basic facts are repeated. Just like you may take a course in higher mathematics. You know, in seventh or eighth grade you learn algebra. Okay, for children that's a complicated thing. You know, one of these numbers, X, Y, Z, those aren't numbers. Then children have to be, you know, have to be educated about what's algebra. How to add together letters instead of numbers. But before the teacher goes into the details of algebra, he makes sure in the beginning the students still remember that 2 plus 3 is 5 and how to do division and multiplication. If they forgot that, then they're not ready to proceed into algebra. Like that, we have to make sure the basic facts are remembered before we get into the details of what our spiritual life really involves. So actually, Srila Prabhupada, in his preaching, he was preaching to modern people who have forgotten, even the Indians have largely forgotten their spiritual training. Or the younger generations don't get any spiritual training. Why do young girls nowadays, all over India, even in the holy places, they're dressing like prostitutes would not dress 15 years ago. I was in Bangalore 25 years ago. You wouldn't see a young woman dressed in pants, not even a prostitute. What has changed? The parents, sad to say, have neglected to prevent their daughters from doing this. They have not trained up their daughters spiritually in the actual principles. And now these young people going to the universities, young boys and girls, you know, as partly as a result of this change in dressing habits and other habits, they're having illicit sex together while in school. 10, 15 years ago, young people would never think of doing that. They were always thinking, you know, even though their sex drive is there among young people. But previously, even 15 years ago, young people could not do it because they're thinking, well, how could I disappoint my parents by doing such a thing? But that's being lost. It's being lost. That spiritual training is missing. The parents are not giving adequate spiritual training to their children. The children are still, these young generation, they're still in many ways decent children. They're still respectful to adults. You know, they're not as bad as some of the people their age in the Western countries. But wait one more generation. I went to get my computer fixed in Delhi. Young people in their 20s were working in the office. They asked me my address. I told them Vrindavan. They didn't know what Vrindavan was. They never heard of the place. People living 150 kilometers away from the place of Krishna's childhood pastimes, they never heard of it. You know, they have lost their culture practically completely. So what are they going to teach their children? They may still be pretty decent, even though they get in trouble sometimes. But what will their children be like, the next generation? I can't imagine. So this is a degradation of culture because of lack of spiritual training. These basic, but it used to be, at least, in India, even today, everybody understands the principle of reincarnation. But we forget the ramifications. Because we're going to be born again, we have to be careful what we do in this life. We will have to pay the consequences of what we do wrong in this life. The sinful things we do, we will not get away with it. We will be punished, if not now, then in the future. That we forget. So, Krishna is anticipating this Bhagavad Gita is going to be read 5,000 years from now. So I have to talk not just for Arjuna, but for the future audience. And I have to therefore repeat these very basic facts in the beginning. You're not this body. You're eternal spirit soul. But your body is going to die. And it's going to be born again. And you have to enjoy and suffer the reactions of what you're doing now. Basic facts. But Krishna is telling Arjuna, this is a reason why you shouldn't be upset that you're being asked to fight against Bhishma and Drona. Because they're going to die anyway. I've already arranged, they're going to die in this battle. They're not going to survive past these 18 days. I think Bhishma lasted 10 days, right? First 10 days of the battle. Then he's finished. Drona lives for another 4 days after that, I think. Bhishma Parva, then he's killed. Drona Parva, then he's killed. Then who takes over after him? Karna, yeah. So Karna lasts for a while. So 14 days, and both Bhishma and Drona are going to be dead. Whether you participate in killing them or not, they're going to be dead. And even if somehow we change the fate and they survive the battle, they're old men. How long are they going to live? And for them to leave the battlefield without shedding their blood would be shameful. So better they die gloriously. So many arguments Krishna is implying in this statement. It's unavoidable, and it's your duty. So just go ahead and fight. And then Prabhupada points out that this does not make an excuse for unnecessary killing. It's one thing that the personality of Godhead has arranged this battle. And therefore, it is a righteous fight. It is proper execution of duty for the professional kshatriya to fight such a battle. It cannot be said that the battle is unjust. And someone like Arjuna cannot claim to be a non-violent person. He's a violent person by profession. Kshatriyas have to use violence. A king has to use what is called danda. Punishment. But punishment means violence. Vada means to kill someone. It's very often translated as murder. But technically in the Dharma Shastras, it's one particular form of capital punishment. If a person has committed a serious crime that should be punishable by death, then he should, first of all, voluntarily surrender himself to the king. That's the right thing to do, rather than hide. The criminal should come to the king, and he should carry a big club and offer it to the king. Please take this and smash me on the head. That is called vada. When the king takes a big club and hits you on the head as hard as he can. That's the technical meaning of vada. It's a particular kind of punishment. There's some slight chance you might survive. That's okay. Then that's your fate. That you survive with some brain damage. You know. But otherwise, it's almost certain death. And then later on, the word vada came to mean any kind of murder, killing of a human being, or even of an animal. But that is the business of the king. It's his duty. If he decides to become nonviolent, like as Emperor Ashok became a Buddhist, it's a little uncertain in the history whether he actually never fought again. It looks like he maintained his kingdom and continued to fight wars, even after he became a nonviolent Buddhist. But what if a king decides? Like Arjuna, Prince Arjuna here is making a decision, I won't fight. Now all of a sudden I want to become nonviolent. It's avoidance of his duty. If a king does not use danda, punishment, including the punishment of vada, of killing those who have to be killed, then he gets sinful reaction. Manu, in the Manu Smriti, Manu Samhita, specifically says that a king gets 1/6 of the pious credits of his citizens. He can take 1/6 of their gross income as tax, but he also gets 1/6 of all their good karma, if he does his duties. But if he specifically neglects to use danda, to be violent when he has to, if he pretends to be nonviolent, then he's punished for that. He gets 1/6 of all the sinful reactions of all the citizens. And if it's not a very small kingdom, that's certain that he'll be dragged to hell by that. Just by trying to be nonviolent. So Arjuna shouldn't do that. He shouldn't become nonviolent. When Prabhupada first went to New York to preach Bhagavad Gita, he ran into some opposition from the young hippies who were fighting against the Vietnam War. Make love, not war. And here's this Swami from Calcutta telling them about Krishna telling Arjuna to go fight a war. So some of the hippies found this repugnant. And they argued against Prabhupada, but Prabhupada argued back. He explained to them very clearly, this is the duty of the Kshatriya. This nonviolence is okay for Brahmanas, and maybe it's okay for hippies. But for a Kshatriya, he has to fight. He has to use violence. That is his dharma, his duty. If you don't like violence, then don't become a Kshatriya, become a Brahmana. A Brahmana can do his duty, and he shouldn't be violent. Doing the same duty, basically, the Kshatriya is protecting human society. Protecting dharma, the religious principles of human society. Both the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas are cooperating in that same work. But the Brahmins do the protection just by teaching and by maintaining the religious principles themselves. By teaching Shastra and living Shastra. They don't use any violence, the Brahmanas. But the Kshatriyas help maintain religious principles by the force of their arms, by power, and that includes using violence. So Arjuna has to be reminded of that, and also philosophically has to be reminded that you can't kill the soul. All you can do is destroy the body, which is going to be destroyed sooner or later anyway. Hare Krishna. So we'll stop here. Does anybody have any comments or any questions? Yes, pardon?
In the same context,
yes.
Kings were, we've read in history that there's like kings of this Vijayanagara Empire.
Yes.
They were giving human sacrifices.
Kings of Vijayanagara were doing human sacrifices?
Before Krishna they were either.
You mean like the Shaivite kings?
No.
Vaishnavas?
Before Krishnadevaraya was a Vaishnava, but before that there was a lot of irony.
Okay. So, and they were doing human sacrifices.
Yes. Okay. Like, there's a book called The Kingdom of Nrsingha.
Yes.
The bothered the town of Vijayanagar. So just because of one huge tank they were constructing, it fell off. So one Brahmana came and suggested something and angry with him. So the king immediately arranged for 64 men to be sacrificed and 4,500 buffalo. So human sacrifice even otherwise, like Purusha Medhan.
Yes. I think that's not in line with Shastra. I think that Brahman was not good, giving good advice, and the king was foolish to follow it. Because in Kali Yuga, it's forbidden even to kill a cow or a horse in sacrifice. Ashvalambam gavalambam. Ashvalambam gavalambam. Sacrificing a cow or a horse is forbidden in Kali Yuga. What to speak of a human being? What record do we have in the Vedas of an actual human sacrifice? Some scholars speculate and say that the Purusha Sukta is describing a human sacrifice. But they're misinterpreting the word Purusha. Purusha doesn't mean a human being, it means Garbhadakshay Vishnu. And they took the ingredients for the sacrifice from the body of Garbhadakshay Vishnu because at that early time in the creation, nothing was manifest. The demigods had not put the universe together yet. So only the universal form, which is the body of Garbhadakshay Vishnu, was available. They didn't kill the Purusha. That wasn't a human sacrifice. Other incident is when Shunakshepa was meant to be offered by his father. Or actually, what was his name, the father? His son was Rohita, his actual son. And Varuna gave him the blessing to have that son if you sacrifice him to me when he's 6 months old, or whatever, 6 weeks old. And Varuna, the king, forgot his name. That wasn't Harishchandra, was it? No. No, some other king. No, somebody else. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He told Varuna, let me wait till the boy's teeth grow in. You know, I'll give them to you for sacrifice then. And he kept on stalling. Finally, he ran away with his son, went to another city, and he purchased somebody else's son, Shunakshepa, and was going to sacrifice Shunakshepa, the purchased victim, to Varuna. But Varuna stopped him at the last minute. Shunakshepa was saved, because Shunakshepa offered very glorious prayers to Varuna, and Varuna was pleased with him. Anyway, so there's the other incident of the Rig Veda of almost performing a human sacrifice, but it didn't happen. So what record do you have of the actual performance of Purusha Medha? Except for in recent history. In recent history, you have all sorts of abominable things happening that are not according to the Shastric injunctions. Now, that's Kali Yuga. Yes, when the Kamakya Devi temple was reopened in the year 1819, when the British were there. This is Guwahati, right?
Or? In Assam, yeah.
They killed 119 men for the inauguration of the temple, re-inauguration. And the British, you know, couldn't stop it. But that's abominable. That's against Shastra. In Kali Yuga, this animal sacrifice, what to speak of human sacrifice, is forbidden. And I don't know if the human sacrifice was ever actually performed. It's just theoretical. You know, only, you know, dakus go around killing people and call it human sacrifice. And, of course, these kings, they're slaughtering so many of their citizens, sending them out to war. You know, so, you know, 64 men, thousands of men are killed every time there's a war. That's also human sacrifice in a way, but it's not a proper yajna. Not according to the Shastric injunction, not for Kali Yuga especially. Okay? Yeah. Hare Krishna. Anything else? Okay, thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.